I'm Jim Haskell, Senior Portfolio Strategist. Earlier this autumn, we collaborated with one of our clients on a multi-part exploration of U.S.-China relations. Joining me in this series are three people with extensive experience in the U.S.-China realm. I welcome Ray Dalio, our founder and co-CIO, Kevin Rudd, the former Prime Minister of Australia, and David McCormick, our CEO and a former senior official in the Treasury and Commerce Departments, as well as the National Security Council in the George W. Bush administration. The conversations you will see in this series are drawn from a video cast with Ray, Kevin, and David, and from a live session with our client, which was captured on audio. Excerpts from these two sessions will make up the content for this series. Throughout this series, you will hear us refer to three different scenarios for how the relationship could evolve. First, a high-friction scenario, similar to the current path of increased tensions. Second, a lower friction scenario, wherein the two countries reach a sort of detente. And third, an unlikely scenario marked by major reforms to China's policies and a return to the engagement model of the past decades. In part one of this series, Ray, Kevin, and David discuss the arc of the U.S.-China relationship, how we got to this point, and where we might go from here. In part two, they surveyed domains of economic competition between the U.S. and China, and considered how trade, technology, and capital control policies may change in the coming decade. In the following podcast, Ray and Kevin consider the implications of U.S.-China tensions on global markets and for investors. They discuss how Chinese economic policy may evolve, and Ray explains the importance of diversification and what that means in this new environment. To begin with, I asked Ray to comment on China's long-term prospects and the challenges it faces, including the debt overhang. The audio follows.
You referred to the problems. I've been intimately involved with them and the policymakers, and I watch it. And I would say, can hardly think of a policy that I would have done that would be much different. But you have to take the particular leadership. When Deng Xiaoping's administration came in, they do believe that from 2009, the G20 meeting and the issue of creating a lot more debt and the use of fiscal policy led to a rise in debt to GDP and so on. And I've had very intimate conversations with those who were responsible at that particular point. That was viewed as a bad policy and problems. And so it was really in the second term of Xi's term that Liu He was put in charge of dealing with the debt problems for the most part. He was as vice premier, and that they put into place Guo Xiqing, who is responsible for really dealing with the triangular debt problem and so on. So when I first went there, basically my feedback to them and so on was that money is clogged at the top because five major banks lend money to state-owned enterprises and you couldn't get capital through the system. Then they had the development of the shadow banking system, and now they're having the reforms of that. And if you watch how that's being done, it's being done smartly by standards that, let's say, would be world-class standards. As far as their capacity to deal with debt, the debt is denominated in their own currency. They can restructure debt. I could list all the four major severe or worse debt crises that the United States has been through that I've been involved with in various ways. I won't digress into that, but there's a real basic question of debt and where they are in the debt cycle and what's their capacity. The capacity to restructure a debt in local currency is almost unlimited. We've done it many times. And if you look at the general capacity to have a credit market and all that's associated with where their interest rates are, I've commented before on there's monetary policy 1, 2, and 3 that you could use as markers of where you are in your debt cycle. They still have their monetary policy 1. They still have the capacity to use interest rates. They coordinate fiscal and monetary policy very well. They have normal tools. They have attractive capital markets, and they offer an interest rate on real. And you're seeing the exchange rate benefit from that. Then there's monetary policy QE and the like. And now we're in monetary policy 3, in which our particular credit markets and so on. And then our levels of indebtedness. are, so everything's comparative, you know, in investing that everything's comparative. So if I line up their income statement and their balance sheet and so on, certainly the power of the United States dollar as a reserve currency is a tremendous power that we're in a position of jeopardizing because it creates the means of the squeeze, but the squeeze creates the changes. And so you're seeing the development of new clearing systems and digital currency that will work in a certain way that will be beneficial to the RMB and so on. So if I take all of the financials, their level of debt relative to ours, their ability to handle it relative to our capacity to handle it, all of those types of things, where their interest rates are, what the pricing of the assets are, where the listings are, you're seeing a movement of the listings from New York. They can say you're prohibited for listing. But what that means for a practical investor is you know that if you want to participate, then you'll be buying that stock and you'll bolster the Hong Kong and Shanghai stock exchanges because the listings will be there and that will bolster that as a financial center. So when I look at all of that and I'm looking at the finances, I say, what is not advantageous in that direction other than perhaps the politics? But I don't know that they don't win on the politics too.
I agree completely with Ray on debt. It's his area of expertise as well. But I have been reading at least for 12 years now, reports from various governments around the world about how Chinese debt levels were about to cripple Chinese growth levels. They've yet to materialize. And the key point in Ray's analysis is that practically none of it's internationally denominated. But my point on the economy and growth prospects is not related to debt. It's to do with the center of gravity on the political economy. What Ray has just pointed to in terms of, I think, a serious set of market-based reforms, which the Chinese have introduced to, let's call it credit allocation, mindful of advice from people like Ray saying the money's not getting through to the real economy, that is the private sector. It's going from five state-owned banks into a whole bunch of SOEs rather than filling the credit needs of the new burgeoning private sector. Now, that has been a real area of market reform. But when I look more broadly across the Chinese economy in the last several years, since about 2015, 2016, the pace and direction of market-based economic reforms, which Xi Jinping announced way back in 2013, by and large has not been implemented. And there's a reason for it, because in the internal debate within the system, and it goes back to some of the questions we've already discussed here today, Xi Jinping is concerned about ceding too much political control to the Chinese private sector. It's now 60% of GDP. Private firms and the up there in the stratosphere like Alibaba, others, you know, the HNA plus crowd, if you like. Xi Jinping has sent a message to the Chinese political economy settings that I do not want this economy to become totally dominated by the private sector. If you want evidence of that, in the last 2 weeks alone, the speech which Xi Jinping delivered to China's top entrepreneurial leadership about them needing to become members of China's international united front activities on behalf of the country and the party is more of a reining in of, let's call it, the private entrepreneurial exuberance that we've seen over the previous decade. Now, these companies are still going to grow. My thesis is not that it's just therefore going to collapse. What my thesis is that the economic growth level will now be suboptimal because senior corporate, private sector corporate leadership in China does not have the same level of unbridled confidence in the future that it had, say, prior to 2015, 2016. Nothing to do with COVID so much, not so much to do with the US-China trade war, everything to do about the fact that the political economy settings are tilting more outside the finance reforms that Ray just referred to, more in a state direction and less in a private sector direction. I think that impacts long-term on growth. Doesn't mean it stops growing, but it won't be the same trajectory that we've become accustomed to. Ray and I will have a different view on that.
From a market perspective, the prospect for capital controls poses a number of risks. Ray, I wonder if you could discuss these risks and how we as investors should approach them.
I think you have to worry about capital controls in the United States over that time frame, almost about as much as you would have to worry about capital controls in China. So when you do the comparisons, it's a challenge. And I would say that one will need to think about capital controls more generally in the period that's going to be coming ahead. I really think one should think about it in the United States and as well. You even have to think about, you know, what is a reserve currency? We're used to something that is an extension of peaceful times and almost globalization, and that's the globalization of trade and capital markets and so on and so forth. I think you have to remember that the monetary, prior to 1945, the new monetary system, we created a new monetary system. That new monetary system prior, when they had confrontation, nobody would trust each other's capital or money. And there were plenty of capital controls. And the way you would pay for things, and we also have to think about, you know, what is a currency reserve? I mean, we're in a gap because we're at the point where I think the U.S. dollar is threatening its status as a world reserve currency, but there are not good choices as a currency. That's why we see other storeholds of wealth. Traditionally, stocks are a storehold of wealth. Gold is a storehold of wealth. And so on. You're seeing movements of that sort in that direction. So when you look at the capital issue, it'll be a capital issue for possibly a number of countries. And then let's say you step back and you look at investing in general, it emphasizes the importance of diversification. Because, you know, you could look at China and with a bias toward thinking capital controls and so on, or you could look at China and you could say the amount of foreign investment in China or the amount of holding of Chinese financial assets as a financial investment is minuscule relative to the size of its economy or the size of its capital markets. And you could look at the United States as saying the holdings of other countries with dollar-denominated assets and so on is enormous relative to the size of the American economy or even the size of its capital markets. And then you look at diversification. Diversification is, I think, the main thing to pay attention to. And you could say, well, you have, let's say, technology is an important issue, industries and so on, and they're connected also. Whoever wins the technology race wins the military race too. You know, I mean, that whole thing. And you say, well, where do you want to bet? And it's really, well, how confident can you be in any bet? You want to have, I think, proper diversification. So that's how it looks to me in the capital markets and related to capital controls and related to all the issues pertaining to capital.
In the second session, Ray elaborated on the importance of diversification and how investors should position themselves. The audio follows.
First of all, I think it's so important to say, like, what are your market capitalizations? Why do you have them? You know, in other words, how would you balance if you were just using expected return, expected risk? Are you for historical reasons, but also don't make any necessarily good sense? Are you overly skewed in one place or another to take that look? So I would say most portfolios are very, very underweight in China relative to the United States or other countries. But I would break countries, now step back, and I would say, well, there would be three levels of answering that question. First, the diversification question, and second, how attractive they are. On the diversification question, it seems to me that you could say every place is its industries that it's producing and its P&L. So if you're looking for technology, big technology, you're looking at the United States and you're looking at China, and there's not much place going on elsewhere in the world in that kind of scale, let's say, but there are differences. So I would say you also have to look at, you know, there's country diversification and there's currency diversification. So I would say there's the United States and there's China. And then there are those countries that are going to be immune from those things, healthy countries that have good balance of payments situations and so on, attractive markets and so on. And so everything is on a relative basis. So A, look at your portfolio. What is balance and why does it make sense? And are there historical habits that have kept you that way? Secondly, then there's these two countries which are leaders in those particular technologies. You have to think of it as an industry by industry thing, but let's say to the extent that's a powerful influence, not just on those technology companies, but in their whole environments. Insurance, like in Penang in China, that's important. And then go to other countries that are not going to be involved in this, that have strong balance sheets, good income statements, and civil populations.
Kevin, Ray brought up the U.S. dollar and the risk of losing its reserve currency status. How do you assess that risk? Do you anticipate that the RMB will threaten the dollar status?
This debate has been ongoing for the last 20 years. From China's perspective, what does it fear most in the world? Two things, and perhaps three. The U.S. military, the U.S. dollar, and U.S. semiconductors, probably in that order. And the great thing about Marxist-Leninists is they tend to reduce things to ultimate equations of power. And so that's kind of the baseline of the analysis of what constitutes the elements of American power, leaving aside all the other drivers of America's national, economic, and political circumstances today. And so the future of the currency, therefore, is right up there in terms of China's perceived sense of future global vulnerability. So on the one hand, the United States would, China would dearly love to be free of any pressure in the future that it would be placed under, either through direct financial sanctions being placed on China through the US dollar, or through economies using the US dollar for their international financial exchanges against China. Or secondly, in the absence of hard and fast sanctions, any other restrictions which begin to emerge in and around America's continued control of the global reserve currency. So what has China sought to do in response to that? A range of different things. It's tried to introduce a whole range of renminbi currency swap arrangements with 20 or 30 countries around the world to use the renminbi as the currency of intermediation for bilateral trade between China and those countries. The ultimate constraints still remain as follows. China will be reluctant to fully liberalize its capital account and to fully liberalize, therefore, the convertibility of the RMB on open foreign exchange markets. And the reason we'll be ultimately skeptical to do so, reluctant to do so, is that it does not want to place its politics in the hands of the of international financial markets, where it perceives not an invisible hand at work, but one giant American hand at work. And that's ultimately the Chinese constraint here. So what might they do? Here is my view. It's possibly an unpopular view, but my personal view is as China's aggregate economic mass grows during the decade ahead, analogous to the way in which it conceives of its military capabilities growing in relation to the United States, as China's financial reserves and China's financial capacity to become itself a global investment powerhouse increases and rivals and exceeds that of the United States over time, which is currently not the case, then China, when it believes that it is immune from any external currency market or capital market manipulation, may well take the plunge to liberalize its currency as this decade of the 2020s progresses. I put that sometime into the second half of the 2020s. And I believe it is meshed closely in China's mind with scenarios that we've also discussed about what may happen in the Taiwan Straits and the risk of financial sanctions being imposed against China under those circumstances. In other words, how do you reduce and or eliminate your exposure to US dollar-denominated financial sanctions at a time when you're going to accelerate geopolitical risk around the world by taking action against Taiwan? Well, in advance of that, you immunize yourself by floating the RMB at a time when you believe the RMB will be of sufficient size and weight to dominate global capital markets, irrespective of what markets may then conclude about the desirability of the RMB, given the ultimate problem of the capacity of the Chinese state to politically intervene in the value of the RMB on a given day and on the manner in which capital markets operate. So I believe China may well be playing to a medium-term strategy based on aggregate size of its capital markets relative to those of the West, then taking the risk to liberalize exchange rates in the capital account, and then basically daring the rest of the world to take action against it using US dollar-denominated sanctions if and when national security scenarios arise later in the decade over Taiwan.
In the second session, to close, I ask Ray if the US dollar does weaken and it loses its reserve status, what would that devaluation look like and what would it mean for investors? The audio follows.
Well, in terms of magnitudes, I look back at March 1933 devaluation. I look back at the 1971 devaluation, and those of the are of the dollar. And then I look at other currency cases and so on. It depends if it takes place in a conflicting, you know, like a war kind of environment. If you take Germany and Japan, for example, in a war kind of environment, which exists as a possibility, that was a total wipeout of everything and total debt. So I would say the order of magnitude would be somewhere in the vicinity of 30%, you know, but there's a big range around 30 to 40%. But it has a cascading effect on a feedback loop. That what happens is the United States is able to spend more than it earns from the rest of the world. And we have built up all this IOUs, and people are holding bonds, and you're holding bonds, and everybody's holding bonds in that thing. If you lose that, you start to lose that whole dynamic. And then you have to ask yourself, history has shown, you have enough of an exchange rate depreciation to bring the balance payments into equilibrium, which means that you're now running surpluses. And so you have to ask yourself when that happens, what amount of extra output to the world are you going to give the world? Or what amount of cutting of your expenses are you going to give the world? And what is the magnitude of decline? If that were to happen, it would be devastating politically, because it means at a basic level that Americans get to spend less. In other words, it's like budget controls, or you have to raise your productivity level. You can't raise your productivity. I mean, it's not, you do what you do with productivity. And so it represents a, you know, the great decline, the end of the empire and all of that. And it means a lot of political problems and all of that. It is a very dangerous situation. And we don't know if it'll happen. But if you use the markers of it, you'd have to say it's the biggest risk. And it is a significant possibility. So it's the thing that you would want to insure yourself against in some capacity.
That concludes this series on the future of U.S.-China relations. Thank you so much.